From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Interim Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis joins us to talk about the relentless surge in shootings. Mayor Rawlings Blake told WIPR the city is making progress.
I think one murder is too many in our city, and I'm vigilantly working along with the police department, along with our federal partners, our state partners, and the community to get us to where we need to be as far as having a safer city. But it's very clear to me that since we've implemented the war room that we're seeing progress in focusing on those most violent repeat offenders.
We'll ask the interim commissioner about that war room and other crime-fighting tools and building trust with the community. Then, after every mass shooting, there's a national debate about guns. We'll hear from a philosopher who argues the gun lobby is making us less safe and less free. And the Environment in Focus with Tom Pelton. First News.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. 2 days before the end of July, Baltimore has recorded 39 homicides so far this month, almost as many as the 42 murders in May, which was the highest monthly count in 25 years. A dozen killings in just the last week. 3 weeks ago today, Kevin Davis was promoted from deputy to interim commissioner when Mayor Rawlings Blake fired Commissioner Anthony Batts. Interim Commissioner Davis has set up what he calls a war room to coordinate the fight against crime. He's asked rank and file to email him their ideas about how to reorganize the police department, and he said he'd like to see the interim erased from his title. Interim Commissioner Davis is here to address such questions. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks for having me back.
We have cleared the decks to spend most of our show with you this morning, so which means we'll take a break for news in the middle of our conversation. I've tried to organize my thoughts, so we'll talk about what's going on now, the crime fight first, and later talk about some of your plans for changes. Could be the conversation won't work out that way, I realize
sure.
that. But to start, the violence, the
right.
shootings especially, the
right.
murders, tearing the city up, tearing families
right.
up.
Right. Very, very concerning to the police department, to the community. We held a press conference yesterday announcing that we closed three more homicides. It's really important that we close these homicides as quickly as we can because we're convinced that there are people out here who are responsible for more than one homicide, more than one non-fatal shooting. And it, as quickly as we can partner with the state's attorney's office, U.S. attorney's office, our federal law enforcement agencies, whatever we can do to get these folks, these trigger pullers off the streets, that's what we're doing. And that's kind of where the war room concept came into play about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, I want to ask you about the war room. When Mayor Rawlings Blake did a crime walk last week, that was one of the points that she made to WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns.
It's very clear to me that since we've implemented the war room that we're seeing progress in focusing on those most violent repeat offenders.
Progress. It doesn't feel that way looking at the numbers.
It doesn't feel that way looking at the raw numbers, but I look at numbers that give me an indication, objective numbers that we're heading in the right direction. So as I look at the number of guns, for instance, that police officers in Baltimore are taking off the streets, 45 guns in the last 7 days, that's up 150% from the same time last year. And just in the last 1 month, we've taken 159 guns off the streets, and that's up 83%. And you look at drug seizures, because there's a big conversation in the community about police officers post Freddie Gray. Have we taken our foot off the gas pedal?
And that's, oh, yeah. There's a lot of concern about that.
And that's a conversation. And the only way for me to really dive into that is to look at objective numbers. And these numbers don't lie. So in terms of ballistic hits, so those are up 118%.
Ballistic hits.
The shell casings that we recover from crime scenes, and we compare those shell casings against guns that are recovered. So I mentioned that our gun seizures just in the last week are up 150%. So now we have a gun that we can compare against shell casings recovered from crime scenes, and those ballistic hits are up 118%, which tells us that that gun that we recovered maybe on the east side of town is connected to the shell casings we recovered on the west side of town. And then we use the war room mentality to insert names and human beings into that equation. And then drug seizures is another really good indicator that police officers, uniformed police officers, are out there doing their jobs. So drug seizures are up 41% citywide. So that's the last month compared to the month before. So that's encouraging to me. And just in the Western District, and obviously, you know, Sheila, the Western District is the unrest, the Freddie Gray incident happened in the Western. So drug seizures in the Western District this month compared to last month are up 157%. So when I hear talk and conversation about police officers perhaps taking their foot off the gas pedal for whatever, the statistics, the productivity tells me a different story. But I'm certainly nothing that doesn't erase that from my mind.
You were talking about now. Do you think there was a work slowdown right after the indictments of the six police officers?
Well, I think there was a lot of anxiety within law enforcement. And I think that anxiety that existed in Baltimore probably existed throughout the country. Just, you know, we hadn't had a riot in Baltimore since 1968. And none of the police officers here now were around in 1968. So we really didn't know what to do with it. And we didn't really have the training and the equipment, certainly didn't have the experience to deal as effectively with the unrest that we would have liked. And that's where our preparedness is coming into play now. And I really hope that it's another 47 years before Baltimore has another incident of unrest. But in the event that it happens before then, we're going to be ready for it, and that's what our community expects.
Are you in better shape now than you were on April 27th?
Absolutely. So there's three ingredients, I think. It's experience, training, and equipment. Now we have the experience that we didn't have before April 25th. So I really look at Saturday, April 25th as the first that day at Camden Yards. So we have the experience now. So we're all of a sudden subject matter experts. So we've been there. We've gone through it. We've made the mistakes. We've learned the lessons. And now we have the training and the equipment to go along with it, because the training post Freddie Gray was very basic civil disturbance training. You know, it occurred in the academy. Here's a helmet. Here's a nightstick. And here's a shield. But it
you
didn't
said
really much go beyond
post
that.
Freddie Gray.
Has improved, is what I'm trying
to
say.
When you described it as basic, you were talking about training pre
Freddie Gray.
Okay.
And then our equipment, our police officers compared to surrounding jurisdictions, our equipment was not adequate. It didn't protect our police officers the way it needs to protect our police officers, and that equipment now is in. We have sophisticated training that's taking place right now, and then we also have the less lethal tools now that we had to borrow from other jurisdictions during the unrest. So we're the eighth largest police department in America. We shouldn't have to borrow anything from anybody. So now we're postured in the event, and again, I hope it's another 47 years, but now we're prepared with training, equipment, and experience to deal with it.
It's interim Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis here on WIPR, Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the crime fight. As you know, Ray Kelly is president of the No Boundaries Coalition, a citizens group in West Baltimore. He spoke with NPR's Rachel Martin on Sunday. I want you to hear part of it.
It seems like the officers are ready to come back out and patrol the streets, but it's more the high command and the administration that wants to, for lack of a better term, research and study what's going on when it's the same damn thing that's been going on for 30 or 40 years. We know what works. It's time for the police department to come out early in the morning before the drug shop set up and put the drug dealers on their heels for a change, and they need to do it till it works.
What would you say to Ray Kelly?
I agree with that sentiment. Sometimes law enforcement engages in what I call paralysis by analysis. So young cops early in their career kind of get themselves in trouble by acting without thinking. And I think when we get further along in our careers and we take these leadership positions, I think oftentimes leaders in our profession think without acting. So we're going to act. And I've been doing as much as I can to restore the morale, because morale in law enforcement is a very real thing. So I've been doing as much as I can, all the little things, because it's always the little things at the end of the day, like giving the officers a venue to communicate with me directly. And I'll tell you, Sheila, and I didn't plan to do this, but I rescinded the long sleeve policy for police officers who have tattoos on their arms. Now, I didn't anticipate the positive reaction that was going to receive on the agency, but that small gesture to police officers who are out here each and every day that makes them more comfortable doing their jobs boosted their morale. And I still hear about that every day, and we made that decision a little over a week ago. So anything I can do to boost morale, show my support, be present, be out on the street with the police officers, I'm going to do that.
How do you think citizens feel, especially the residents in some of these really hard-hit communities like Sandtown, feel in hearing that, because the corollary of saying police officers are pleased that they can wear short sleeves in hot weather, and you're implying that therefore they're going to be more active in patrolling. The corollary is that they've been holding back because they're unhappy about something.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. I don't think there's a corollary. I just think it makes police officers feel more comfortable about coming to work. Just like the police stations. I think our oldest police station, we have 9 in the city, was built in 1958. So the mayor and her staff have made a real commitment, and I've actually visited a couple police stations with the mayor's staff to do some little things at these stations to create an environment that makes police officers feel better about coming to work. So I think when we look at those little things and the low-hanging fruit, I think we create an environment where police officers have greater job satisfaction, and greater job satisfaction correlates to greater productivity.
I mean, we're talking, this is obviously, by definition, a life and death situation. Baltimore has been losing a person a day in this crime surge. Over job satisfaction?
No, not necessarily over job satisfaction. But in this moment, so when we look back at 2015 down the road, morale is going to be a big part of the conversation. And I think it is fair. It's going to be a fair review and critique of my leadership. Did I do enough to restore morale? So I take morale very, very seriously. I take the crime fight very, very seriously, but I think morale and a crime fight go hand in hand, and the community. So the idea that in Baltimore, you know, Sheila has been around the Baltimore Police Department since 1784. We are a traditional police department. And for years and years and years, we have been enforcement oriented. We've been the warriors. So we need to transition from warrior to guardian. So we need to transition from enforcement oriented to community oriented. So it's a transition that's taking place in law enforcement nationwide, but there's a hyper focus of it on Baltimore because of the unrest. The world is watching Baltimore, and we have to lead the way.
We have to take a short break here. We have a lot more questions for Baltimore's Interim Police Commissioner Kevin Davis when we come back. Stay with us on 88.1.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast in the studio with Interim Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis. We've been talking about the crime fight in light of the violence in Baltimore, the war room. Describe it to me. Where is it? Who's sitting there right now that on a weekday morning? What's happening there?
It's in headquarters. It's our analytical intelligence section. And who used to sit there by their lonesome were crime analysts. And crime analysts are civilian personnel. They're really smart, technical people who can get into data and retrospectively look back at crime and crime numbers and come up with projections and theories about crime and crime patterns and crime trends. So the difference now is we have a blended approach. So the war room includes those very same analysts who have always been there and detectives. So the analysts and the detectives literally sit side by side. And the analogy I use is if I had a puzzle to put together of 1,000 pieces, I can't put that puzzle together with you over the telephone or via email or text message or conference call. And I look at a lot of these cases in Baltimore with the connectivity with East Side, West Side, and the same names keep popping up. We have to dump the pieces of that puzzle out on a table, and we literally have to sit there together and figure it out. So what we've been able to do is run cases out of the war room, not just conduct analysis. So we've got three or four strands right now of violence going on in the city, and those violence strands are being run out of the war room. So there's an 11 o'clock briefing and a 4 o'clock briefing every day where detectives come together with analysts in very real time and put together pieces of this puzzle. It's effective, it's real time, and it's a real time approach to violence. And we've been able to connect the dots quicker than we have before.
How many cases have been solved in your estimation because of the war room?
Well, in the last, let's see, 30 days alone, we've solved, well, let me put it this way. Since May 1st, we've solved 21 homicides. We've seen a couple surges recently where we've been able to solve three murders at a time. We announced three closures yesterday. We announced three closures a couple weeks ago, the non-fatal shootings. So we're accelerating our capacity to solve cases. And the same names, just like the gun that's recovered on a bad guy on the west side of town and the shell casing that's recovered at a crime scene on the east side of town, there's a person or persons associated with those objects. And what the war room does with the analysts and detectives is it puts together those bits of evidence with detectives' knowledge of who's out there, who are the players. So it's really a blended approach to crime analysis that includes detectives. And historically, these analytical intelligence sections have been run predominantly or exclusively by crime analysts.
And yet the department's homicide clearance rate right now, I read, is 36% compared to something like 45% is more typical.
Typically, we're about 45%. That's the national average. We're right at or slightly above the national average, typically annually, for homicide clearance rates for cities and big counties of over 500,000 or more. But what's encouraging is this. Back in April, before the unrest, we were just over 60%, which is phenomenal. Mm. So from April to July, it's the surge in violence, the unrest, the other factors that contributed or have contributed and are contributing to the violence have just introduced a volume of homicide cases to our detectives. So while we're at 36.3% right now, we're not going to stay there. There's no way we're going to stay there. We're going to keep getting better and better. I have every expectation and that we are going to continue to raise that clearance rate.
You, as I mentioned, have been in this job 3 weeks. It'll be 3 weeks this afternoon. And yet you already say you intend to reorganize the department.
Yes.
How did you arrive knowing that's what you want to do, and what do you want to do? And what are you hearing from the rank and file whom you have invited to email you?
Well, feedback. One of the first things that I did the first week, and sometimes it feels like 3 weeks ago, and sometimes it feels like 3 years ago, but one of the first groups of people we met with were detectives. And the detectives told me that they feel that they're not as connected with each other as they used to be. And when we looked at the way the organization is structured, there are detectives in different bureaus on the agency, so they're siloed from one another. So the reorganization is not going to be anything too terribly overwhelming. We're going to go from three deputy commissioners to two deputy commissioners, and we're going to put everyone who considers himself or herself a detective, with the exception of internal affairs, under the same chain of command, so that they have the clarity that they need to do their jobs, and they have the avenues that they need to communicate with one another to help do things like enhance clearance rates. That was the feedback that I got from the police officers that led me to some of these decisions.
What else are they telling you?
Promotions. So 30% of the command staff is in an acting capacity. And, you know, I talked about anxiety earlier. Command staff has anxiety because 30% of them have been in an acting capacity for a long time. So are they going to stay or are they going to go? It just relieves that anxiety in their mind to make promotions. And we intend to make promotions later this week and to announce the reorganization of the agency later this week. And we also plan to address two other big concerns that the agency has. I've been working with Gene Ryan, the president of FOP Lodge 3.
The Paternal Order of Police. Yeah.
The shift plan doesn't work. And we got away from posts, and we're going to go back to posts. So a post is a beat. A post is a geographically defined area where a patrol officer is tasked to patrol. And we've gone away from posts. And it's kind of like removing the number on the back of my football jersey. I need a number on my jersey. I need to know what geography I'm responsible for so I can be held accountable. So when we hold police officers accountable, I can tell you right now the boundaries of my original post, my original beat, when I joined the Prince George's County Police Department. I can tell you that.
How many years ago was that?
24. But the police officers are screaming for a better shift plan, and they're begging me to go back to posts, and I intend to do those things.
The shift plan, so you're talking about revising your contract with the
Well, it's a contractual agreement with the FOP. So the FOP is considering reopening that part of the contract. Gene Ryan, he's hearing the same things I'm hearing. And Gene has the same responsibility to his membership as I do to the men and women of the organization. And that's to take care of them, listen to their concerns, and create an environment that makes them productive. So Gene and I really agree that this needs to be revisited. And we're going to revisit the shift plans to make sure that what looks good on paper actually works in reality. So our shift plan right now looks great on paper, but in reality, it doesn't work as well as we thought it would work. And I think it's a sign of mature leadership when we make a change within an organization. If that change doesn't work out, then we look at it, we revisit it, and we make adjustments.
You're listening to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Baltimore's Interim Police Commissioner, Kevin Davis. We're talking about the fight against crime. Are you planning to put more emphasis on foot patrols?
Yes, absolutely. So foot patrol is an art form. So it's not enough to tell police officers that they need to spend an hour or so out of their cars every day. As I drive throughout the city, I see plenty of police officers out on foot, but I oftentimes see them out on foot standing on a corner or standing by themselves. So the next part of that is, okay, you're out. Now how do you engage? And I got really encouraged the other day when I was driving through Pigtown and I saw a police officer from behind. We're driving up the street and he's out on foot. He's literally twirling his old baton, you know, the Baltimore baton twirl that's been around for ages, and he's talking to a group of people. And I got so excited that one of our young patrol officers was out there really doing a real foot patrol, not just walking on foot and being out, but engaging people. And I got out and encountered a 42-year veteran who's actually a homicide detective who was detailed to a foot patrol assignment. So how do we get people who grew up on this organization, who know the art form of foot patrol, to teach our younger cops what it means to engage in a real foot patrol?
WIPR reporter Kenneth Burns talked to Mayor Rawlings Blake, as I mentioned, on a crime walk last Thursday. Here's some of the points she made.
The relationship between the community and police is just that, a relationship. And in order to maintain a relationship, you have to invest in that, and you have to invest your time and your energy, and that's what we're doing. We're out here being in relationship with the communities that we serve, making sure that we are doing what the community needs us to do to meet their public safety needs, but also the other agencies we have here, transportation, DPW, housing. All of us are out here together trying to focus on the crime and the grime and improve the quality of life for these communities.
And meanwhile, there's continuing stream of national headlines about issues with various police departments, police-involved shootings and deaths in prison. How does this continuing stream of national headlines involving police violence, suspicions of violence, how does that affect Baltimore police officers?
Just like any other police officer, but we happen to be in the national or international spotlight right now. So the world is watching Baltimore, and Baltimore really it epitomizes, for better or for worse, all the challenges associated with American law enforcement. I talked about that warrior to guardian transition that the president's 21st century report on policing describes in great detail. And I think far too many police departments consider it a choice between being a crime fighter and a community ambassador. Pick one. Well, we can't afford to pick one any longer in this profession. We have to be both. We have to be that crime fighter and that community ambassador. And there are 18,000 police departments in America. Some get it, some don't. But I'm excited about the opportunity to lead the way, because when Baltimore gets this right, and we will get this right, we'll be the national model for all other 18,000 police departments to look at. How did we come back? How did we do it? How did we rise from the ashes of this unrest and get better? And I'm excited about that opportunity, because Baltimore cannot afford to fail, and we won't fail.
Do your officers see an incident like a Freddie Gray incident, like a Tyrone West incident, someone who died in police custody, as an individual incident, or do they see it as part of what some people see as a pattern?
A larger conversation. I think the further along we get in our careers, the older we get, I think we have that 30,000-foot perspective of things. But the average 25, 26-year-old police officer in America, and that's how old our cops are. The police officers that you see out there, you know, pushing marked patrol cars, wearing a uniform, they're young folks. They're also the folks that have the most contact with our community members. So it's a challenge of leadership to compel and encourage these younger police officers to see law enforcement from a higher perspective.
You have been very frank that you're interested in this job permanently. You know as well as anybody that there is a mayoral primary next spring. How realistic is it that?
Well, I don't know if I've been frank, but I've certainly acknowledged that I'm interested in being the police commissioner in this great city. So, but all I can do in that regard is come to work every day and work as hard as I can for the community, work as hard as I can for the men and women of this organization. And then I can only control what I can control. And I promise the community and the police department this, that I'll leave everything on the field. So my very best effort is what they'll get out of me every day.
We're out of time. I've got a lot more questions, but no more time. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Jill.
Kevin Davis has been Baltimore's interim police commissioner for 3 weeks. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. At noon on midday, Dan Rodericks talks to Luke Broadwater of The Sun about the deluge of emails the city coughed up in response to The Sun's Freedom of Information request about how things worked during the riot. I'm Sheila Cast. After a break, thinking about guns in the wake of another mass shooting. Stay tuned to 88.1.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Interim Police Commissioner Kevin Davis spoke with Sheila on the first part of today's program about the need to get guns off of city streets. He tells us that just this last week, 45 guns were removed from circulation, 159 guns in the past month. He says that's up, you know, quite a bit, 150% or so since the last time. So he's certainly got this very much on his mind, and efforts to enact legislation in Maryland to accomplish that goal have been, compared to many other states, actually quite successful. Maryland has some of the toughest gun restrictions in the country, but those who oppose tighter restrictions on registering and owning firearms would point to the fact that tough gun laws have not seemed to retard in any way the tremendous spike in gun crimes that Baltimore has experienced in the last few months. Nationally, we seem to revisit the issue of gun legislation in the aftermath of each new tragedy that occurs. The recent shootings in Lafayette, Louisiana, and Charleston, South Carolina, like the murders in Newtown, Connecticut a few years ago, prompt a conversation about guns that eventually peters out and leads to no substantive change in the status quo. Furman de Brabander is my guest this morning. He's professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and he asks a basic question in his new book entitled Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at the Pratt Library. Furman, it's good to see you.
Thank you.
So the short answer to the question that you ask in your title is no, they don't make us any more free. And you defend that position in a way that's interesting and different than many advocates for gun control. You write that they are often in the unenviable position of advocating for greater gun safety by curtailing personal liberty. Yes. What is your approach to the argument?
Well, yes, my approach is to point out that in a society where we have an abundance of guns, and we're talking somewhere between 270 million to 310 million privately owned guns in America, and in a society where we have an abundance of gun-friendly laws and loose regulations, our freedom is going to be progressively endangered. And in my book, I look into, you know, discussions of freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and how those will be endangered thanks to the proliferation of guns. I consider the campus carry movement, which is a movement across the country. I think about 9 to 10 states right now have this, where they allow guns to be carried by people with concealed carry permits in college campuses. And as a college professor, I try to imagine what that's like, having guns in the classroom. I do not believe that the prospects are positive for free speech in the classroom. And there were cases where people carried guns to protests in the past few years, and the impact of that was rather chilling. So I don't believe that the NRA is correct when they say that guns equal freedom. They may bring freedom at a certain point, but after another tipping point, which I think we're well past in the society, guns do not make us free. They compromise it, and they will progressively endanger our democracy.
So you talk about guns as the central struggle of our democracy. Is there a distinction between freedom and security?
I mean, philosophically speaking, yes, there is, but we need to feel safe in order to be free. And the irony is that the NRA and the gun rights advocates argue we need ever more guns to feel safe, and yet the opposite is happening. The more guns we have out there, the less safe we are, the less free we are.
Maryland has a limit on the number of handguns that you can buy in a month. You're allowed to only buy one.
Mm-hmm.
It has, as I mentioned, some of the toughest gun laws in the country, although
right.
you point out that there are many, many loopholes
sure.
even here in Maryland. What do you say to the folks who say all these tough gun restrictions don't do anything to curb crime? I mean, the argument, of course, is that criminals don't register their guns
right.
anyway. Why should anybody?
Well, it's a preposterous argument, because we are surrounded by states with loose gun laws and plenty of background check loopholes. Private citizens can get their hands on guns very easily. In a society with 300 million privately owned guns, it's not hard for anyone to get their hands on guns. So no matter how strict jurisdictions gun laws are, they're always in danger when they're surrounded by, you know, jurisdictions that have loose gun laws. And I'll give as a case in point Chicago. Gun rights advocates always say, well, look at Chicago. They have strong gun control laws, and they have, you know, tons and tons of guns and tons of shootings. Well, you know, as the police chief over there has pointed out, they're surrounded by jurisdictions that do not tamp down on the number of guns that flow very easily into the city of Chicago. So that is a very difficult battle to fight, so long as we do not have a federal or national approach that will restrict the number of guns out there and will enforce background checks. We're not enforcing background checks for these guns. And as long as that happens, guns can get in the hands of criminals very easily. It's as if the NRA wants these guns to get into the hands of criminals.
How do you account for the fact that, you know, 80% of people say they support background checks, for example, particularly after the Newtown massacre
right.
in Connecticut? You know, the president made a full court press about at least that part of gun legislation, and then it just fell apart?
That is the central question that I have about this book, which is, why is it that if you ask people about individual measures of gun control, like universal background checks, how they, you know, a majority of people, even gun owners, will say they are in favor of them. And then if you turn around and say to them, but how do you feel about gun rights? They say, oh, I'm all in favor. How do you feel about gun control? I hate it. The interesting thing about the gun rights issue is that it has become a casualty of our political polarization, I believe, and our culture wars at the time. If the president is in favor of gun control, then his opponents are instinctively against it. And even though so many people are in favor of background checks, there has not been the sufficient willingness or power behind the movement. And that's the problem, is that the gun control movement seems to be lacking that kind of passion that is matched on the other side. And with my book, I hope to start a movement or start the conversation that people who are in the middle, who favor these gun control measures, might be made aware that these measures, you know, that our situation is sufficiently alarming and that we need to throw our support behind gun control in the same way that the few that are in favor of gun rights throw their support passionately behind their movement.
Well, Ferber de Brabander, I appreciate your coming in. That's all the time we have, and have a wonderful time tonight at your discussion at the Pratt.
Thank you, Tom.
Ferber de Brabander, he's an associate professor of philosophy at the Maryland Institute College of Art. His book is called Do Guns Make Us Free? Democracy and the Armed Society. He'll be speaking about the book tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Library at 6:30 up in the Poe Room. It's part of the Pratt's Writers Live series, and we've got information on our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday here on Maryland Morning, a history of bluegrass music in Baltimore. It's a rich and deep history, believe it or not, and we'll talk with the historian Tim Newby, and we'll listen to some rare recordings. We hope you can join us on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
Maryland Morning is an original production
of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Johnna McCone
and Connor Graham.
We have production help from
Christy Forrest
and Scott Seiss.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1974, Cass Elliot, better known as Mama Cass, the voice of the singing group The Mamas and the Papas, died in London. She'd been born Ellen Naomi Cohen in Baltimore just 32 years earlier. Overweight her adult life, she died of a heart attack, not, as rumored, from choking on a ham sandwich. We're back on Friday. Please join us.